what we've been seeing is essentially a dismantling of our public health guidance.
The CDC has changed its position. Its website now says vaccines might cause autism, even though science says they don't.
For Monday, November 24th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Tech companies are pouring billions into AI chips and data centers. Increasingly, they're relying on debt and risky tactics.
Financial analysts are worried there's a bubble that will soon pop.
There's been a lot of talk about an AI bubble. From our vantage point, we see something very different.
And researchers have unearthed new details about a 13th century cold case involving the brutal murder of a high-profile royal.
Also, millions of millennials are now caregivers for their own parents while trying to build their own lives.
I had never even stepped into a nursing home before. At this point, I was 32.
First, this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. A federal judge has dismissed the indictments against former FBI Director James Comey and New York Attorney General Letitia James, saying the appointment of Lindsay Halligan, who secured the indictments, was invalid because she was unlawfully appointed. In a video on his Instagram account, Comey says he's grateful the court ended the case.
I know that Donald Trump will probably come after me again, and my attitude's going to be the same. I'm innocent. I am not afraid, and I believe in an independent federal judiciary.
The cases were dismissed without prejudice, meaning the Justice Department may be able to bring those cases again. Halligan is a former insurance attorney who once served as Trump's personal lawyer before becoming a White House aide. Trump tapped her to serve as acting U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia after he pushed the previous top prosecutor out, who had expressed doubts about bringing the charges. Venezuela is rejecting a U.S. plan to designate the country's president and several military officers as members of a foreign terrorist organization. John Otis has more.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio designated the so-called Cartel de los Soles as a foreign terrorist organization for its alleged role in drug trafficking. The Trump administration says that the cartel is made up of high-ranking Venezuelan military officers and led by President Nicolas Maduro. The Venezuelan government is rejecting the designation today, calling it a, quote, ridiculous fabrication, and insisting that there's no such thing as the Cartel de los Soles. The terrorist designation comes as the U.S. has positioned warships and thousands of troops near the coast of Venezuela, raising expectations of a possible military strike inside the country. For NPR News, I'm John Otis.
Wall Street sharply higher by the closing bell, led by rallies by AI companies. NPR's Scott Horsley says this shortened trading week will be a busy one.
Investors are growing more optimistic that the Federal Reserve will lower interest rates again when policymakers meet in a couple of weeks. Comments by prominent Fed officials in recent days suggest worries about the job market could be outweighing concerns about stubborn inflation. That makes a rate cut more likely. Now that air traffic controllers and TSA agents are getting paychecks again, they'll be busy this week as millions of holiday travelers take to the skies. The FAA is forecasting its busiest Thanksgiving season in 15 years, while the TSA expects nearly 18 million people to pass through its checkpoints. The stock market will be closed for the holiday on Thursday, and Friday's trading session will end early. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
And by the closing bell, the Dow was up 202 points, the NASDAQ up 598, that's up 2.6%, S&P 500 up 102. You're listening to NPR News. President Trump says he will visit Beijing in April and host China's President Xi Jinping for a state visit. The two leaders spoke by phone today about trade, Taiwan, and Ukraine. Trump says the two sides kept their trade agreements current and accurate, and that the leaders can now set their sights on the big picture. The call comes several weeks after a summit between the leaders in South Korea, where officials agreed to a year-long trade truce that rolled back many of Trump's tariffs that he imposed on China, along with China's retaliatory tariffs in return. The rapper Childish Gambino revealed over the weekend that he had a stroke last year, which caused him to postpone and ultimately cancel his world tour. NPR's Andrew Limbong has more.
Childish Gambino, real name Donald Glover, performed at the Camp Flognoff Festival in Los Angeles this weekend, and during his set, he caught the crowd up on what he'd been up to. During the New Orleans date of his 2024 world tour, he had a bad pain in his head and he couldn't see well. He went to a doctor who told him he had a stroke, and he says further tests revealed he had a hole in his heart, which required surgery. Glover's been releasing music under the Childish Gambino moniker since 2011. Before the release of his last album, 2024's Bando Stone and the New World, Glover told the New York Times that it'd be his last under the name. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
Crude oil prices higher near the close, up nearly 1.5%. That's a gain of 85 cents at $58.91 a barrel. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Check KXE.org for more information about food-related resources across northern Minnesota, with hours of operation and locations of food shelves, along with information on soup kitchens and community meals. Add resources in your region by emailing news at KAXE.org. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE.
From NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. A federal judge has dismissed the Justice Department's cases against former FBI Director James Comey and New York Attorney General Letitia James. The federal court found the prosecutor who secured the indictments was unlawfully appointed. This ruling is a major setback for the Justice Department and for President Trump himself, who publicly called for both Comey and James to be prosecuted. NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas joins us now. Hi.
Hi there.
So, Ryan, the prosecutor in question here is acting U.S. Attorney Lindsay Halligan. What do we need to know about her?
So, right. Halligan is a former insurance attorney who later became a White House aide after Trump returned to office. Trump then handpicked her in September to serve as the acting U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia. And he did so after forcing out the previous top prosecutor there, who had resisted bringing charges against both Comey and James because of concerns about the strength of the evidence. Now, days after Halligan was appointed, she secured a two-count indictment against Comey on false statements and obstruction charges. Those are tied to testimony that he gave to Congress in 2020. Mm-hmm. Important point here, this was just days before the statute of limitations expired. 2 weeks after the Comey indictment, Halligan, again on her own, secured a separate indictment against Letitia James for bank fraud and false statements. Both Comey and James pleaded not guilty. They also both challenged Halligan's appointment, saying that it was unlawful, and a federal judge has now agreed with them.
What did the judge say in this ruling?
So this is a ruling from U.S. District Judge Cameron McGowan Curry. She was appointed to the bench by President Bill Clinton. She's actually based in South Carolina, but was brought in specifically to handle legal challenges to Halligan's appointment. And what Judge Curry found is that Halligan's appointment violates a statute that governs interim U.S. attorney appointments, as well as the Appointments Clause of the U.S. Constitution. And because of that, the judge says in her ruling, everything that came after Halligan was appointed, including the indictments against both Comey and James, all of that was unlawful. And so she dismissed this case, but she did so without prejudice. And that means the Justice Department could, in theory, refile the charges, although it's unclear how exactly that would look. With Comey, there's an added complication, and that's that the statute of limitations has now passed.
Right. Any reactions so far from James Comey or Letitia James?
Comey put out a video statement on Instagram. He said the case against him was based on malevolence and incompetence. He said he's grateful that the court ended it. He also said this.
The message has to be sent that the President of the United States cannot use the Department of Justice to target his political enemies. I don't care what your politics are. You have to see that as fundamentally un-American and a threat to the rule of law that keeps all of us free.
Now, for her part, James said in a statement that she's heartened by the ruling. She said she remains fearless in the face of what she called baseless charges. And her attorney, Abby Lowell, said they're going to continue to challenge any further what he called politically motivated charges.
Have we heard any word from the White House or the Department of Justice yet?
White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt was on Fox News today. She said the judge here took what Leavitt called unprecedented action to throw out these cases on a technical ruling. She said the administration disagrees with this decision. And she argued that Halligan was legally appointed. And she said the Justice Department is going to appeal. So in her words, Leavitt's words, Comey should pump the brakes on his victory lap. Mm. Stepping back for one second, though, it's worth noting that this is just one of several legal challenges that Comey and James had raised against their respective prosecutions. They've also argued, for instance, that these were vindictive prosecutions, that they were being targeted for political reasons. So the fight over Halligan's appointment was just the first one that came to a head. And for now, at least, it was a clear win for the defense.
NPR's Ryan Lucas, thank you.
Thank you.
The CDC, long one of the country's top, most trusted health authorities, is now claiming that a link between vaccines and autism cannot be ruled out. This change comes even though a connection between vaccines and autism has long been debunked by a large body of high-quality research. The guidance is also a break from the American Academy of Pediatrics, who published the so-called Red Book on Pediatrics Guidance. Dr. James Campbell is a practicing pediatrician who helped write that guidance. He's a professor at the University of Maryland School of Medicine and joins us now to talk about what this will all mean for the kind of information that parents have access to. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
What do you make of this change from the CDC, and what do you think it means?
Yeah, so, I mean, over the last few months, what we've been seeing is essentially a dismantling of our public health guidance of our public health agency, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. As people probably know, it's the premier public health agency in the world. And the people that work there are the best public health officers, epidemiologists, statisticians, subject matter experts on everything having to do with my world, which is infectious diseases and prevention of those infections. And recently, they've not really been given the opportunity to continue to do that stellar job of providing evidence-based guidance. And essentially, website pages and others have been hijacked, if you will. And they're still stating that they're representing the CDC, but I think if you talk to the people that work in this field in the CDC, they're going to tell you like they had no part in changing those guidelines. So it's confusing, I think, for the general public. It's confusing for practitioners and for parents. But you know, we believe that people, if they look into what the rationale is behind the guidance, they'll be able to see that the American Academy of Pediatrics continues to do science-based and data-based guidance.
Are there ways that that conversation is going to look different now, given the changes that we've seen at the CDC over the past year?
I think it is going to change, because what makes it to the media, to the news, is that there is controversy between the different groups that make recommendations. And so in the past, pediatricians, you know, had maybe a difficult job sometimes in discussing recommendations about vaccines with families, but now trying to explain the different recommending bodies and why one body would choose one thing and another thing, I think is going to make those conversations even more difficult.
You've seen the trend lines on public views of vaccines over the decades, and you know, I'm sure there's a lot of people listening right now who maybe in one way or another do have skepticism or worries about vaccines. What would you as a doctor say to that just kind of baseline concern or anxiety in a parent, especially at this moment now when there is multiple messages coming in from multiple authorities?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I would say is I'm a parent too, and I vaccinate and have vaccinated all of my children because after reviewing all of those data, I know just how much goes into checking on their safety, on their tolerability, on their efficacy. I'm in the unfortunate position, if you will, of being an infectious disease doctor who spends his time in the hospital caring for children who have very severe disease because they were not vaccinated. I see children with influenza who are on mechanical ventilators. I've seen children with COVID lose a lung. I've seen people die from hepatitis B after 2 liver transplants. All of those were preventable problems with simple vaccination.
That is Dr. James Campbell, a professor at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Researchers have unearthed details about a 13th century cold case involving the brutal murder of a high-profile royal.
First, let's set the scene. Imagine a nunnery in Budapest, Hungary.
A place where the devout might have sung chants like this one. About 800 years ago, a duke was murdered near this convent.
Béla of Macho. So he was the duke of the Árpád dynasty.
Béla of Macho was a pretty important Hungarian duke.
And this dynasty ruled the Hungarian kingdom for almost 300 years.
That's Anna Széchenyi Nagy, a geneticist at the Research Center for the Humanities in Budapest. She says in 1272, Béla went to a meeting near the nunnery with some rival lords.
He was invited to a council there, but instead of a council, it was probably an assassination plot.
The lords thought the duke was a threat to Hungary's young king.
Béla was accused of treason and of secretly collaborating with the king of Bohemia.
The medieval histories all said that Béla had been killed. So when a damaged skeleton was found buried under the convent centuries later, in 1915, archaeologists figured it was Béla. But they had no way to be sure.
Now, a huge group of researchers have picked up where the archaeologists left off. Széchenyi Nagy's team compared the skeleton's DNA to samples from Béla's royal dynasty.
The nicest and most solid proof was basically the analysis of shared autosomal segments, which we could compare with two known kings of the Árpádian dynasty.
The body was his, but the scientists still had more questions.
Was it an accident, or was it really interpersonal violence leading to death, assassination, duel, or some brawl that he did not survive?
Martin Troutman is a forensics expert. He examined the nearly 800-year-old skeleton.
At first, never heard the name before. I heard of some of the major Hungarian kings. Maybe I never heard of Béla because he was killed before doing something really great.
Troutman found 26 wounds on the duke's body.
It was clearly visible that these were not fractures or blunt trauma, but from cutting and slashing. Falling down the stair was no explanation for these wounds.
Through a painstaking process, he pieced together what happened in the duke's final moments.
He suffered blows from the front, from the right side, and from the left side.
Multiple people attacked him. Troutman says Béla wasn't wearing armor and likely never even drew a sword.
An attacker inflicts much, much more damage and wounds that were necessary. There was this, I want to kill you, but I want to kill you.
The intensity of the blows proved one final detail of the story for Trout. The people who killed Béla were likely known to him and may have been the very lords he had come to meet.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:18, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is your daily dose of phenology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from the state. We receive support from Beltrami Electric Cooperative, your Touchstone Energy Cooperative, providing energy to keep lights on, coffee hot, and batteries charged. Connecting communities, empowering life in northern Minnesota for more than 80 years. More at BeltramiElectric.com. Now for your daily dose of phenology.
On today's date, November 24th, 2009, Ed and Maggie Anderson from the Big Fork area report seeing a leopard frog today. Leopard frogs are not like the wood frogs, the tree frogs, the spring peepers, and the boreal chorus frogs, who all winter in the leaf litter. The leopard frog winters in water, and it will find a lake or a pond. It will go to the bottom and sort of nestle itself into the mud a little bit, more just cover itself lightly with mud for camouflage, probably. And then it will remain there through the winter, and it can obtain oxygen through its skin, so it doesn't need to come to the surface to breathe. It can get enough oxygen to stay alive, and the cold water sort of slows down its metabolism so that it doesn't need to eat and doesn't need to be active. So unusually late for a leopard frog to be out and about, but as long as the lakes are still open and there's still open water available, I guess it won't be the end of this little fellow.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. For many people who unexpectedly become caregivers to a family member, it's hard to know where to start. That was definitely the case for me and my family. While it's gratifying to be able to care for a loved one, it can also feel hard to find community or to know what resources are available to help. That was Jennifer Levin's experience when she became a caregiver for her father. She told me it was all new to her.
I had never even stepped into a nursing home before. At this point, I was 32.
According to AARP, there are about 10 million millennials who are family caregivers. When Levin first came across that data from 2015, she was stunned.
I thought, this is one in four of us. I know more than four people.
So after her father died, she founded an online community that focuses on millennials who are finding ourselves navigating this process.
There's no reason we should be going through this alone and trying to reinvent the wheel each time.
The community that she founded is called the Caregiver Collective, and I wanted to know what the members have taught her.
So when, you know, you have an average idea of whom a caregiver is, a retired, maybe probably, woman who's taking care of even more geriatric parent, you know, they've already built their lives. Whereas when you're doing this at a younger age, you are thinking about, well, how am I going to date when I'm also responsible for somebody at home? How can I explain to somebody what I do and that there's always a priority that's going to usurp our plans? How can I have children? Can I afford it if I'm caregiving? Do I have the time? How do I afford a wedding? There are a lot of considerations that came up because of the age that we were at when we were caregiving. And then there was also the fact that as millennials, a lot of us came of age and entered the workforce during major economic crises. And we've, you know, grown up with a gig economy that has then been compounded by COVID, compounded by unprecedented student loan debt. And you add on the costs of caregiving, whether that's financial costs or the time taken away from hourly wages, you know, that sets up an entirely different economic catastrophe.
Just on a practical note, I think so many of us who are millennials are in that sort of messy space of trying to make sure that we handle it all right. Like if we have children, making sure that we pour into our kids and raise them well, while also making sure that an older adult, or as you note, perhaps even a spouse in our life, they require care and they have needs that are often on demand. They can't wait. Do you have any advice for people who are in that space now and trying to figure out how to make both things work, both sets of caregiving work, if you're a part of that sandwich generation, like at the same time?
My advice for people who are caught in this conundrum is outsource by identifying people or a person in your life who has available resources to take some of the burden off of your plate. What is something that you'd be comfortable one time or even regularly passing off to somebody, whether that's, you know, helping to babysit so that you can either, you know, take somebody to a doctor's appointment or even just go take a walk for yourself. Who can help you drop off a meal or pick up the groceries that you're unable to get because your kid is sick and you can't leave them alone with the person that you care for? I also really recommend reframing the idea of self-care. Self-care has been sold to us as bath bombs.
So you're saying not the face masks and the manicures and the pedicures?
Those are lovely, but no, that is not at all what I'm saying. When we talk about caregiving, stress levels are so intense that it leads to negative coping mechanisms like drug abuse, alcohol abuse, even suicide ideation. So self-care needs to be truly taking care of yourself, whether that's seeking therapy, finding a community from other caregivers who are your age, who can help mirror your experience back to you, and you can also pick up tips from. These are the types of things that I really underscore when I'm talking about self-care, things that can help you build tools to push you through into the future.
We talked about your role in stepping in to care for your father, and I know that as I am, you're an only child, but a lot of people that I've talked to who are stepping into caregiving roles for parents, they're trying to figure out how to do it, perhaps with a sibling who may or may not be as involved as they are. There may be differences of opinion. Talk a little bit about what you learned about people who are figuring that part of it out and what you might say to someone who's trying to navigate that when people might not all agree what's best for their loved one.
I've seen this in the people that I've interviewed take two different forms. One is that there's the sibling who has gone MIA and you're dealt with the majority or all of the responsibility for care, or siblings that are present, but it's a case of too many cooks in the kitchen, differing opinions. So the advice that I got from one caregiving expert who I interviewed was, when you're dealing with the notion that you are taking on more care responsibility than any of your siblings, to really remember your value and worth, set boundaries, and communicate explicitly by asking for what you need. So this is quite more difficult than it sounds. I do hear of siblings who ask for help and don't receive it, which is why I say the communication and explicitly asking for what you need can break down some of those barriers. If you explain, this is how it's impacting me by me doing it all by myself, maybe that doesn't even break through the wall. So advice that I was given was to turn to an outside party to mediate. This can take the form of a trusted family friend who can remain impartial. It can be a social worker from the hospital. It can be an elder care attorney, but somebody who can step in on this conversation, because sometimes a sibling may hear you differently by hearing it from somebody else.
I feel like for so many of us, this is a topic we don't talk about or we don't think about until we're actually in it. But the truth is that the majority of people in this country are going to need some form of long-term care at some point in their life. So I do want to ask Jennifer, how can a person who maybe hasn't become a caregiver yet prepare for the financial impact? Are there conversations that they can or should be having now with the people in their lives, or financial steps that they could take to be as prepared as possible, knowing that situations change and circumstances change?
I think financially, it's very difficult to prepare for this because you have no idea what the needs are going to be. But what I would say is that something that's incredibly important to line up in advance is all of the paperwork. And this involves bringing in an elder care attorney, one that is licensed for your state, because every state is different, and knowing what pieces of paperwork is it helpful for us to have in place before anything happens in the event that something does. You know, who is financially responsible? Is it anybody? Is there a living will in place? Are there medical wishes in place and stated explicitly? Where would you want to live? How would you want to be cared for? All of those conversations before they're loaded are incredibly helpful.
We've been speaking with Jennifer Levin. She's the founder of the Caregiver Collective, and she's also the author of Generation Care, The New Culture of Caregiving. Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. AMRI receives support from Itasca Economic Development Corporation, creating and retaining quality jobs in Itasca County through education, research, and connections with businesses, working to help grow small businesses of all sizes and strengthen our local workforce. Learn more at itascadv.org. The Heartland Lakes Community Tree Lighting is Friday, November 28th at 6 p.m. in downtown Park Rapids. Many local businesses will be taking part in a Yuletide sampler that evening, and you can find Santa and Mrs. Claus at Bella Cafe.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. This year, five Native Americans were among 29 people named Bush Fellows. The Bush Fellowship provides up to $150,000 over 2 years for the fellows to build on their leadership skills. In the second of five profiles, Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire highlights what a South Dakota University administrator wants to accomplish.
John Little is the Director of Native Recruitment and Alumni Engagement at the University of South Dakota. The Standing Rock Sioux tribal member works with many Native students and wants to get more fired up for higher education. He says part of getting many ready is adapting from small Midwestern rural communities to large campuses with many academic offerings.
It is a shock factor for a lot of students.
Boosting Native enrollment and retention will be a challenge. In a census review shared by the Post-Secondary National Policy Institute, data showed that nearly 26% of Natives age 18 to 24 were enrolled in college, compared to 39% of the overall U.S. population. Additionally, undergraduate enrollment dropped 40%, while graduate enrollment fell 18% for Native students. Little says he's been lucky to have parents who've supported his academic goals, including a master's degree from USD and a PhD from the University of Minnesota.
Especially my mom has been really influential in me going to school and has been there every step. Not every student that I work with in South Dakota has that, or maybe they do, but they're first gen, so they just don't know what that looks like.
Little says he'll research college fairs and regional programs to develop stronger preparation initiatives for future students. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
A study aims to shed light on the hidden impacts of domestic violence in Native communities. The Mountain West News Bureau's Daniel Spalding reports on the effort to understand the unrecognized brain injuries many survivors are living with.
The Urban Indian Health Institute survey aims to find out how common traumatic brain injuries are among Native survivors of domestic and sexual violence. More than 80% of Indigenous women have experienced violence in their lifetime. According to Abigail Echohawk, the Institute's director, many survivors of domestic and sexual violence suffer from brain injuries that never get diagnosed or receive proper care.
They deserve justice, they deserve safety, and they deserve to get the treatment that they need when they've been impacted by traumatic brain injury.
The goal of the survey is to ensure survivors get the right care and support through programs and policies designed to help them heal. The survey began in October and will remain open through January 2026. I'm Daniel Spalding.
Another Arizona tribe has been picked to keep a newer holiday tradition going by supplying this year's Capitol Christmas tree. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more.
For 3 years running under Governor Katie Hobbs, the state has taken bids from tribes, beginning with the White Mountain Apache in 2023, then the San Carlos Apache last year. Now the Capitol tree will come from the people of the Tall Pines, or Wallapai.
And I hope no matter who is in the office of the governor, that this holiday spirit of bringing all our communities together continues.
Wayne Clark is chairman of the 2,300-member Wallapai tribe north of Kingman.
Oddly enough, the one tree that has been selected, it's close to, I want to say, about 30 feet, was not one of the three options, to be honest. Councilman Imus did a quick prayer. He turned to the right and said, "That's the tree." We all looked, and it was a moment of awe.
The tribe will bless the tree before trucking it more than 200 miles to the state capitol from their reservation hugging the Grand Canyon's west rim. It will be on display by December 1st. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
The Indian Arts and Crafts Board promotes Indian artists of federally recognized tribes through its online source directory. Information on this no-charge opportunity available at doi.gov/IACB, who support this program.
Support from Clarkson Potter, publisher of Turtle Island, Foods and Traditions of the Indigenous Peoples of North America by Native American chef Sean Sherman. With ancestral and modern recipes, this cookbook showcases diverse foodways of the continent's regions.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from MS Now, home to The Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more, MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. Learn more at ms.now. And from Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their client's best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Concerns that the artificial intelligence industry is in the middle of a financial bubble are bigger than ever. It's not just the billions of dollars pouring into the technology. It's also what's going on under the hood. NPR's Bobby Allen reports on new types of business tactics Silicon Valley is using to pump up demand for AI and to hide the debt being taken on.
If you listen to big tech executives or investors, you hear one thing. We're in an AI boom, not an AI bubble.
AI itself is not a bubble. That's a crazy concept. That's like saying our computer's a bubble.
From our vantage point, we see something very different.
I don't think this was the beginning of a bust cycle or something like that. I still think that we're in a boom. I still think we're in a investment super cycle.
That was JP Morgan Chase executive Mary Callahan Erdos on CNBC, NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang on an earnings call, and White House AI czar and venture capitalist David Sachs on his podcast All In. When you step away from those pushing the hype, another picture emerges. Duran Acemoglu is an economist at MIT who received the Nobel Prize in Economics last year. His research indicates that the impact of AI may be far smaller than the industry is predicting, that just 5% of jobs will be replaced by AI in the next decade.
Much of what we hear from the industry and some of the analysts allied with the industry is exaggerated. The rate at which these technologies will spread, especially in the corporate sector, will be slower than anticipated.
Yet the industry is operating under a much different assumption. Amazon, Google, Meta, Microsoft, and Oracle say they are set to sink $400 billion this year on funding the construction of new data centers. Or to put it another way, every iPhone user on Earth would have to pay more than $250 to cover that tab. Right now, AI chatbots are not profitable. The only way these massive investments in infrastructure would pay off is if they get people and businesses to pay for AI. And right now, most do not. Take the leading AI company, ChatGPT maker, OpenAI. CEO Sam Altman says the company's on track to pull in $20 billion of revenue, but the AI industry is expected to spend $3 trillion on data centers through 2028, according to Morgan Stanley analysts.
We don't need $3 trillion worth of data centers.
That's analyst Gil Luria of the D.A. Davidson investment firm.
And the only way we get to $3 trillion worth of data centers is if we borrow half of that. Borrowing money to make a speculative investment is not a good idea.
So there's a gusher of money pouring into building out infrastructure for a technology that hasn't come anywhere close to meeting the potential its boosters are promising. Then if you get even closer, there are two more things going on with the AI boom that have financial analysts really worried. First, tech companies are using something called special purpose vehicles to keep billions of dollars of spending off their balance sheets. These vehicles are essentially shell companies financed with Wall Street money to build out data centers. Here's Luria again.
They can use this loophole to make their financial statements, their balance sheet, look cleaner and better than they really are.
Financial analysts I spoke to said using billions of dollars of debt and complicated financial instruments to hide exactly how much they're spending on data centers should be cause for concern. The second issue is what's known as circular deals. Here's Paul Kodrosky, a venture capitalist who's now a research fellow at MIT's Institute for the Digital Economy.
So the idea is that I'm NVIDIA and I want OpenAI to buy more of my chips, so I give them money to do it. Right? And that's essentially how this circular financing works. So that you might be characterized as fundraising by, say, an OpenAI, but the terms on the money are, I'm giving you this so you can buy things from me.
A recent $100 billion deal between NVIDIA and OpenAI was structured just like this. The fear is that some of the demand for AI services is being artificially propped up by this kind of circular spending. Kodrosky noted that the last time these kinds of deals were really popular was during the dot-com bubble of the late 1990s. Economist Acemoglu told me, while it's too early to tell, there's a real question these kinds of partnerships raise. Are they creating a house of cards? But the AI industry compares its investments to railroads or the early internet, generational transformations that will pay off with time. And AI execs often say underinvesting could mean that China will race ahead. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com.
In Lebanon, Hezbollah buried its second-in-command today. He was killed in an Israeli drone strike in Beirut over the weekend. That attack has escalated tension, which was already heightened over repeated Israeli attacks, despite a year-old ceasefire brokered by the United States. Correspondent Jane Araf was at the ceremony.
Hezbollah described its chief of staff, Haitham Ali al-Tabatabai, as a founder of the resistance, instrumental in ending Israel's occupation of Lebanon in 2000, and a frontline commander for over 35 years. To Israel, he was one of their most wanted targets, and to the U.S., important enough to offer up to a $5 million reward for information about him. He and four fighters from the Iran-backed militant group were killed in an Israeli drone strike on an apartment building in a residential neighborhood of Beirut's southern suburbs on Sunday. At the memorial, Israeli drones buzz overhead as fighters carry in the coffins. Hezbollah official Sheikh Ali Damush says the killings will strengthen determination to confront Israel. He criticizes the Lebanese state for not protecting its citizens. Hezbollah has not attacked Israel for more than a year, but the ceasefire is in tatters. Israel has struck the south of Lebanon almost daily since then, killing what Lebanon says are more than 300 people. Israel says those strikes are aimed at stopping Hezbollah from rebuilding its weapons capability. The funeral procession begins moving to a new cemetery built because there's no room left in the old one full of Hezbollah fighters. Some of the mourners we speak with are both grief-stricken and enraged. There's a ceasefire on only one side. For a year, there has not been a single shot fired, says Mirna. She's afraid of being targeted and doesn't want her last name used. She says Hezbollah needs to keep its weapons because the Lebanese state is not protecting people. On the street where the drone struck, workers are doing basic repairs.
You can see that a couple of floors of the building have been pretty much demolished. And that's where the Hezbollah members were believed to have been killed. But there were many more wounded, including women and children.
At a bookshop and cafe, Leila Tarhini is cleaning up books damaged when broken snow globes spilled water on them. There are all kinds of books, as well as glass shelves holding Japanese anime and Harry Potter figures.
I'm 100% sure that disarming Hezbollah is not the solution, because it didn't start with Hezbollah. Hezbollah was like a reflex or a reaction for an enemy.
Tarhini says not everyone is Hezbollah, but everyone is trying to resist in their own way. In her case, reopening the bookshop. For NPR News, I'm Jane Araf in Beirut's southern suburbs.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is North Star Stories. Programming on KAXE is supported in part by the Minnesota Humanities Center, distributing more than $6 million in cultural heritage grants. Funding is available to individuals and organizations that will create, celebrate, and teach Minnesota's diverse arts, culture, and heritage, including indigenous organizations, historically underrepresented communities, and recent immigrants and veterans. Details at mnhum.org/grants. The 44th Annual City of Lights event is in downtown Nisswa Friday, November 28th. The celebration includes food vendors, the Polar Express storytelling, Santa's petting zoo, bonfires, train rides, carolers, and fireworks. Floodwood New Life Community Church hosts a free public meal on Thanksgiving Day at 12 p.m. Open to all. Now for North Star Stories.
This is North Star Stories, voices from where we live. Today in Minnesota,
community members and advocates react to federal officers using chemical agents on protesters in St. Paul. UCare announces it will be closing its doors for good. And an important health warning for parents using infant formula. I'm Chantel Sings. Federal officials made several immigration arrests in St. Paul last week, sparking community protests. The federal officers used chemical agents like tear gas against the protesters, prompting community leaders to organize a vigil and call for accountability. Catherine DeSell has the story.
It's ICE, it's police, it's FBI, and it's intentionally very confusing. All of these agencies are deputized to do the work of ICE.
That's Ryan Perez. He's speaking at a press conference about reports he received from the community about a raid happening in St. Paul last week. The raid was conducted by Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, also known as ICE.
Just before 9 a.m., we began receiving reports of federal agencies preparing an operation out of Newell Park.
Ryan is an organizing director with COPAL,
Communities Organizing Latine Power and Action, a Minnesota-based organization that advocates for justice for Latine communities.
We follow our protocol, which is to deploy constitutional observers who peacefully and legally document law enforcement for the protection of civil rights.
The observers, according to COPAL's Handbook for Constitutional Observers, are a group of volunteer-trained practitioners of civil initiative. They followed federal law enforcement to Brotex, a St. Paul manufacturing facility where federal forces from multiple agencies conducted an operation.
A St. Paul dad and his brother, who would move heaven and earth to put dinner on the table for their families, were forcefully zip-tied and removed from this premises.
Protesters at the site were met with violence, tear gas, and pepper spray from federal agents.
Folks that were there peacefully documenting were forcefully assaulted and shoved by officers.
Be defeated! The people united will never be defeated!
Julio Murphy Zelaya is with the Immigrant Defense Network, a group of over 100 organizations dedicated to defending and protecting immigrants.
This is an attack on St. Paul, on Minnesota. It goes against Minnesota values. It feels like federal overreach on our state. It's important for us to push back, to be saying, no, that's not what we want here.
The Immigrant Defense Network offers multiple resources on their website, including what to do if you see ICE agents, what employers can do if ICE comes to their workplace, and what rights immigrants have.
We want people to know their rights, the right to remain silent, the right to deny search, right? These are all embedded in the Constitution and extend to immigrants.
In response, an ICE spokesperson gave this comment about Homeland Security and Immigration, also known as HSI. ICE, HSI, and law enforcement partners conducted court-authorized law enforcement activity and served a search warrant in furtherance of a federal criminal investigation. There is no threat to public safety, and the investigation remains ongoing at this time. For North Star Stories, I'm Catherine DeSell.
You are listening to North Star Stories. UCare, the nonprofit health plan that has served Minnesota for 40 years, will shut down next year. The organization has signed an agreement with Medica, another Minnesota-based nonprofit, to acquire key assets and continue providing coverage to roughly 300,000 UCARE members. Both health plans say people enrolled in UCARE's 2026 Medicaid and individual and family plans will see no interruption in services. The deal still needs regulatory approval, and it's still unclear what will happen to UCARE's employees. The transaction is expected to be finalized in early 2026. Health officials are investigating a multi-state outbreak of infant botulism tied to the ByHeart Whole Nutrition infant formula. Infant botulism is a rare but serious illness that can cause paralysis. Infants across 10 states have suspected or confirmed cases, including here in Minnesota. If a parent using formula notices their child isn't eating well, has a weak cry, difficulty swallowing, or loss of head control, they should contact a healthcare provider immediately. More information at the Minnesota Department of Health's website.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. Many people who count on the Affordable Care Act for health insurance could face stiff cost increases in January, especially if Congress doesn't extend financial subsidies for the program, sometimes called Obamacare. Democrats are highlighting those concerns in swing states like Wisconsin ahead of next year's midterm elections. Chuck Kornbach reports from Milwaukee.
At Renaissance Child Development Center in downtown Milwaukee, a daycare teacher named Marie and about a dozen preschoolers are counting in different languages. Years back, the center looked into providing major medical coverage for the roughly two dozen staff members, but found the cost too high. So many employees, including Executive Director Kara Pitt DeAndrea, are enrolled in the Affordable Care Act. Pitt DeAndrea says she's been greatly helped by the enhanced premium tax credits that went into effect a few years ago.
And the credits allowed me to bridge the gap without concern of going without health care.
Now, with premiums expected to rise and the more generous ACA tax credits in danger of going away, Pitt DeAndrea favors at least a one-year extension of the financial help. The employer, who calls herself a moderate Democrat, thinks that more needs to be done to make sure workers can access affordable care.
That is the reality of what makes a machine work well and a business work well, is that all the parts are taken care of, all the parts are oiled, all the people are given opportunities to be healthy.
Pitt DeAndrea spoke at a recent Wisconsin media call organized by Democrats. At another news conference in Milwaukee with Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin, enrollee Nancy Pesky said if the extra help goes away, she'll face higher costs. The freelance writer said her son just landed a job, but it doesn't offer health insurance.
So he's going to have such an astronomical premium that I'm probably going to have to pay that too. So, yeah, it's going to be very tight.
Officials in Wisconsin say 275,000 state residents make use of the enhanced premium tax credits. A statewide poll by Marquette University found 58% of voters overall in Wisconsin support extending subsidies for the Affordable Care Act, but that most Republicans want to let the tax credits expire. About 50 miles outside of Milwaukee, at a pub in Watertown, about a dozen members of the Jefferson County Republican Party gathered to watch a Green Bay Packers football game on TV. Here, extending help for ACA enrollees does not have a lot of support. Stepping away from the game, Rita Schulte, a retiree who's on Medicare, the federal health program that covers most seniors, says the Obamacare enhanced subsidies should only be extended a short time, if at all. Schulte says for people who aren't retired like her, she wants bigger changes in the Affordable Care Act that lower costs for taxpayers.
If they'd ever get it overhauled, maybe we wouldn't need all this extra help from the government, because you can't rely on the government to support you, I guess.
Brian Norby, who runs an engineering firm and is chairman of the county's Republican Party, says the enhanced tax credits are a political football.
And now they're essentially being used as a political tool to heighten up the Democratic base to come out and vote.
As part of a deal to help end the recent government shutdown, Senate Republicans promised a vote on the Affordable Care Act subsidies next month. Vice President J.D. Vance says the Trump administration has a health care plan of its own coming together. Without providing any details, Vance told Breitbart News he thinks President Trump's plan will even get some Democratic support.
Right now, the American people get crap health care and they pay way too much for it.
But if the White House effort fails, that could upset voters who say Obamacare isn't perfect, but is a safety net they know. For NPR News, I'm Chuck Quernbach in Milwaukee.
More than half of states ban or restrict students' use of cell phones in school. Test scores have been lagging since before the pandemic, and experts say these bans could help them focus on learning. But how do the kids feel about all of this? We're going to hear from two groups of students who offered their opinions to our student podcast challenge. First, from eighth graders at Mount Olive Middle School in Bud Lake, New Jersey, where phones are not allowed during lunch.
We asked students if we should have phones during lunch, and here are their thoughts.
Hi, I'm Frankie Catapano.
Louis Iozzi.
Sanjana.
This is Roman Girl.
Do you think we should have phones during lunch, and what are your thoughts?
I think we should have a system in place to, like, prevent people from, like, misusing phones, but I think we should.
I think yes, because students should be able to have the time to be kids.
Yes, because many kids have them in their pockets and they never have the thought to go on them.
If we had phones during lunch, what would you do?
I would, like, play games on it.
I'd probably watch, like, Netflix TV shows or watch, like, YouTube.
We asked Mr. Barcia, our vice principal, if we should be allowed to use phones during lunch, and here's what he thought about it.
It's a tough question and probably not a kid-friendly response, but I'm going to say no. Lunch is the one time you guys get to socialize and you're actually encouraged to talk to each other and make friends. So using your phones would impede you from actually talking to each other and getting to know people.
Would you ever allow kids to have phones during lunch?
I mean, in theory, I would like to, but to me, it's just sad. Like, you guys don't hang out and you don't talk. Like, when I was your age, you couldn't get us to shut up, right? We would be outside riding bikes and everybody would meet at the park. You guys don't do that. So I don't know. It's dangerous.
That's an excerpt from the podcast Cellular Usage, produced by Mount Olive Middle School's Aria Palmisano, Sanaya Alam, Elijah Verhoeven, and Anthony Pugliese. NPR also heard from students at Bernards High School in Bernardsville, New Jersey, where each teacher decides their own classroom policy.
From my perspective, phones should be banned in Bernards High School. On top of students having the phones be a distraction from learning, there's also the aspect of social media and how it can be a toxic environment for students. There's the whole talk about mental health. So I think it's a very complicated topic. What are your thoughts, Ben?
Well, I don't think they should be banned. I think there's the whole element of what if there's an emergency? I mean, earlier this school year, we saw a lot of stuff going on in schools that kids would need to be in touch with their parents. It can be a helpful resource. An interesting take on this, because yeah. She is an exchange student from Spain. So, Gaia, why don't you let us know about the policy?
I can provide some information about what it is to not have phones at all in school. The policy in my school is that if you are caught on your phone, you get your phone taken away until the end of the month. Personally, I believe that this rule is beneficial for your learning, for your focus, for your concentration, and also for just socializing. I feel like you talk a lot more to your friends and actually have conversations, which is something that I've noticed is just not that common here.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm Ben Ballion, joined today by Jack Martin and Gaia Albanese. We'll talk to you soon.
These podcasts were written and produced by students for NPR's Student Podcast Challenge. The 2026 contest will return in January.
Support for NPR's Student Podcast Challenge comes from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features presenting Hamnet, a story of love and loss that inspired the creation of Shakespeare's Hamlet, directed by Chloe Zhao, in select theaters Wednesday, everywhere December 5th. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options. at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from Hug Hydronics, committed to making in-floor heating simple, providing in-floor heating solutions for both commercial and residential. More information at hughydronics.com. The 16th annual Brainerd Turkey Run is Thanksgiving morning, beginning at 9 from the Brainerd Armory. Proceeds benefit Shriners Hospital for Kids. Runner walk 1 mile for 5 kilometers. Find more info and register at BrainerdTurkeyRun.com. Weather tonight, chance of rain or snow late in the evening. Lows 29 to 33 degrees. Winter storm watch in effect from 6 a.m. Tuesday until noon on Wednesday.